Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, February 9th, 2018. My name is Michael Brooks, pinch hitting for Sam Cedar on a Michael Friday, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Cliffy Cliff Schechter, Friday regular, political strategist, talk show host. We're talking about the never-ending disgustingness that is General Kelly, even though I know, Sam, he's not a general anymore. Former General Kelly. His covering of spousal abuse or beating of girlfriends by a major White House official. A anti-gerrymandering push in Ohio actually passes. Is there some positive news on that front in addition to what's happening in Pennsylvania? And finally, we talk about Trump's dreams of a great, big, beautiful parade. Thanks a lot, Macron. Thanks for seeding him that idea. Then, Corey Pine, host of News From Nowhere podcast, journalist, he's going to come on. He's going to give us a movie recommendation. And we will talk movies, culture, all the rest of that. Rand Paul, he's recovered from his injuries and back to useless gestures in service of his obnoxious politics. We will mock him. Omarosa, she's on a reality TV show now, and it involves the White House. I don't know. We're not going to survive as a species. And what else do we have? We have the fallout of that semi-shutdown of Rand Paul. It led to some excellent comments by some of his fellow congresspeople, which we'll get to. Comments that give us license to do a lot more jokes about Rand Paul getting beaten down by his neighbor. We'll talk about what is actually in the spending bill. Of course, protection for DACA is not in it. All that and much, much more on today's Casual Friday. Full crew today. Brendan is here. Jamie is here. Matt Leck is here. A member of the AFL-CIO Teamsters Goon Squad is here. You like that, right? What's up, Sean? All right, guys. What are we going to start with? Let's start with Pence? That's what you had up? So Mike Pence, who still, when he's not serving as the sort of lead testifier in Trump cult sessions, when he's not trying to usher through some of the most reactionary elements of Republican ideology through Congress, he still likes to sort of walk around and pretend that, he's decent. He's a decent human being. And, it's such a bummer. All right, now I have to take away your health care and destroy your rights. So how does Mike Pence deal with the fact that this guy, Porter, that it's clear now that the administration knew about him beating two women, right? It's two women. They knew about it. They did. It had no impact on his getting hired. It had no impact in his retaining his position. Now, physically beating women is actually still the type of thing that Mike Pence likes to pretend that he cares about. So this is an interesting exchange here where Pence is going to get asked about the Porter situation. And you'll see just how just fundamentally untenable the Mike Pence balancing act slash scam is at this point.
In turn back at home, there, I was wondering if you could comment on the allegations against Rob Porter, the president's staff secretary. When were you made aware of those allegations and how? And then additionally, there are reports now that General Kelly and others at the White House have been aware of these allegations for several months, and have been trying to deal with them and protect him. Do you believe the president is being well served by his senior staff?
Well, let me say we're standing at Yokota Air Force Base in Japan. We're on our way to the Olympics. I learned as I awoke this morning of those developments, and so we'll comment on any issues affecting White House staff when we get back to Washington.
Briefly follow up on that and ask, this is now a number of times when you found out, you're the vice president, you're number two in the administration, where you found out about something very late after a number of other senior staff below you, even in the West Wing, have found out about it. Again, I understand we're standing here, but can you comment on why you often seem a little bit out of the loop on some of this major news?
You know, it's a great honor for me to serve as vice president. President Trump has been incredibly generous with the responsibilities and opportunities he's given me to serve, representing the United States on the foreign stage, as we have here in Japan, as we will later today in South Korea, and of course at the Olympics, and also being involved in the legislative process. And I'm very grateful for that. But we'll leave those White House staffing matters for when we get back to Washington.
So the first exchange was, were you aware of or are you upset that General Kelly ignored Rob Porter being a serial abuser? And his response was, we're in Japan. Isn't that cool? And then the second question was, how do you feel regularly being cucked in this administration, even though you're vice president? And then he said, it's an honor to be cucked. And then he repeated that we were in Japan.
By the way, that was Ashley R. Parker of the Washington Post asking him why he's out of the loop.
I don't, you know, that's the thing, though, is that, like, it's an untenable position in so many ways because, and he tried to do that in the beginning. Like, when he was running, he actually did try to do a double play of, on one hand, nobody's more loyal to the Republican agenda than me, and then on the other hand, hey, I don't know, you know, yeah, if Donald Trump talks about assaulting women, what do I know about that? I'm just his running mate. It's not like we're close or anything. So I think that now his threat as a brand, people's concerns about him as an independent entity, I think they can, not that we should, I mean, we should keep crushing and destroying all of these people as long as they're in any sort of power. But I'm not that worried about Mike Pence. I think why he was a hugely unpopular governor of Indiana who had to take the gig as Trump's VP in order to save his political career is abundantly clear every day. He's a pathetic cult devotee of Donald Trump. He has absolutely no even pretend morals in the pursuit of his agenda, which, as we all know, is an utterly grotesque, like, turning the world into RoboCop meets Hunger Games meets Handmaid's Tale. Those are like the pop culture fusion of what Mike Pence wants for all of us. He's the worst. All right, everybody, we're going to take a brief break, and we will be right back with... Oh, you need a second? We're going to take a break. I'll talk really slowly for you. I'll talk like Sam Harris. All right, we're going to take a break, and we will be back with Cliff Schechter, Dipset, everybody. Sam Harris waking up, Dipset. Thank you.
Diplomats. Come on!
Yeah! Woo. Jim Jones, where you at, baby?
I'm Joel Santana.
This is music right here. Once again, where you at? I feel like Rocky or something, man. Yo, they try to box me in a corner for the longest. No key, lock me in this corner for the longest, but... Come on, man.
They can't...
They really
well said,
let's do this, man. I got him, man. Somehow I managed to creep from under the rock. Linking up with Cam, him linking up with the rock now.
I told you,
come on, man.
I won't fail you.
I got this. Yo, this is powerful music I bring to the table. The sequel of Able, the way I sling. Cause.
Yeah. Let the music talk to him.
Yo, y'all know I'm passing focus. In case you haven't noticed, the blast them open as soon as the
opens.
Yeah,
come on.
I told
y'all
you,
with
man.
Me, man.
Come
Where
on.
At, man?
Cam gon' make me a star. I'ma make him a million. Jones is here. We invading the building. And
yeah, diplomat.
for the last time. We got this, man. But I'm still on the corner grinding for them big stacks. Big, big, don't ever forget that. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Oh, yeah. Yo, and yo, my goal ain't to be number one on your charts. If it happens, so be it. We've been to come with the art. Everyone in my parks, they still moving. Oh, then the front of the show. I do this sick stuff, you congested. They don't give a fuck if you sick, you still get cuffed and arrested. My justice is wretched. You get knocked down, please. Grab your crutches, keep stepping. Cause the game we done held that too long. The pain we done felt that too long. We done dealt that too long. And my pops, it don't help that you gone. Myself to move on. It's scary and I'm gonna need help. Streets flunking me, dogs don't help. Fiends, junkies in the corner don't help. Me deep in my grave on these blocks, I'm a corner myself.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. Michael Brooks here. Joining us now is Cliff Schechter. But before I can throw to Cliff, we need to, of course, play the infamous, the really up there with Dipset, Cliff Schechter theme song.
Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC, New Media, Public Relations, and Strategy. You want any of these services, you know who you gotta see. Cliff Schechter. LibertasLLC.com.
Cliffy, how you doing?
How are you? I'm doing well, man. How you doing, big guy?
I'm doing well. Ready for...
Where's Sam? Is he off on a bender somewhere?
Sam is exactly off on a bender, yes. Sam told me, he said, I'm getting loaded on Manischewitz, and you're going to need to take over tomorrow.
But see, as John Kelly said about him, he's just too damn lazy to get off his couch.
Right. Yeah, he said he called John Kelly. There was a voicemail from John Kelly called Sam a Jew immigrant lover.
That's right. Can't get off his damn couch to do any freaking stuff.
Who is the... You know, I like it because you're getting right to it. There's so many things about... That was a very good segue, which is that John Kelly's a scumbag. So it's like sort of the segue... Yeah.
And racist.
...is the story itself. Yeah. I mean, you know what? We'll get to the Rob Porter stuff in a second. But I feel like the bigger point that always needs to be made is that any media narrative that buys into Kelly, Mattis, that these guys are like the adults in the room... And I have a problem with it in one of three quick ways, which I'll run through. One, they're all abominable, right? Like, they all are, whether they're complicit in abuses overseas or whether they're just trying to carry out the modern Republican agenda. These are not leaders that we should be emulating or giving good press to at all. Number two, even by the standards of this sort of adult in the room narrative, I don't see it. John Kelly ain't no adult in the room. He's just as demented and bigoted as Trump. And number three, right. I think that we can actually start to say, specifically in Kelly's case, because I would apply the not the adult in the room theme, you know, to all of them, Mattis, all the rest of the ones who get that sort of shine, which they shouldn't. I'd say in Kelly's case specifically, he is full Trump. Going back to several months ago in Connecticut, when he kind of whispered in Trump's ear, like, oh, I wish, when they were at that sword ceremony for the Coast Guard, he said, we wish we could use it on the press. And Trump gave him one of his stupid laughs, clearly like just in this total lackey role. So, I mean, yeah, take it through as you see it. But I mean, I think that Kelly is right there at the center of it. And the Porter story, which you can get to, really summarizes all of it along with everything else.
Right. So I think that's all. I mean, everything you said, I agree with. I would say this. I think it's always dangerous when, you know, when we're stuck at a point where we're relying on generals for democracy. Mm-hmm. The caveat to that is, what I'll say is, because of who Donald Trump is, and because of the types of people, Porter among them and others, he's filled his administration with, who are, by various counts, and not that all this is mutually exclusive, completely intellectually unprepared for the job at hand, completely emotionally unprepared for the job at hand, basically just assholes or racists or criminals, you know.
Or all of the above.
In some ways, all the above in many cases. That you do, you know, you look at someone like Mattis and maybe you feel like, well, okay, at least he's been in, you know, served in different capacities. It's not just a partisan appointment. I get in that way why we can sit here, and I've fallen victim to it. We're like, well, okay, hopefully Mattis will stop him from doing something nutty. But I will say it's a sad point in our democracy when that's what we're actually doing. And they should have to prove who they are by proving who they are. You know what I mean? I mean, we should have to see their actions, and that's where Kelly comes in, because he's proven who he is. Mm-hmm. On immigration, he's a racist. On the things he said about Dreamers are him. He protected an abuser in Porter. He's not an adult in the room. You know, look, everyone needs to look past, and I don't think most people who listen to this show are in this particular boat, but I would be talking to mainstream media members. Look past the damn bad, you know, the shoulder epaulettes, if you will. Mm-hmm. Look past where he served. And, you know, when somebody tells you who they are, believe them. I think it was a Maya Angelou quote, right?
Yeah.
I hope it is. Or, I mean, he's
Trump
made clear
said that,
who he
actually.
Is. He did this like, months ago when he attacked a representative from, was it Frederica Jackson, if I remember
the
name
Frederica
correctly?
Yeah, Frederica Jackson.
In Florida.
Right. Yep.
In a racist way at the time, and at the time, you know, with what he said about her, Lawrence O'Donnell had a really moving thing on his show because he's from Boston, you know, and talked about the part where he and Kelly are from, where you had a major battles over busing and these kinds of things. He used language that very clearly was racist language, when you looked at his history. So we've known this guy is not a good person for a while, and he's just now made it more clear that he's every bit as bad. He's Trump with a badge. He may be a little bit smarter, but that's, you know, the bar is not set very high there. I mean, Mike Pence is a lot smarter than Trump. Again, bar not set high. So that's what Kelly is. He has the same nationalist, racist inclinations, apparently, the same sort of giving the middle finger to the media, attacking people, members of Congress. And I mean, you know, he winced,
just to add to it, when he winced at the press conference where Trump made the infamous good people on both sides comments about Charlottesville, when he winced, he's wincing because he knows it's terrible optics, not because he's upset.
That's right.
That Trump is equating anti-fascists with fascists. And so
it's
there's
the PR
an equivalency. Yeah, right. That's what he's anticipating. And I mean, I think, though, it is, even in Mattis's case, I understand what you're saying, and I totally get on a completely base level. If you're like, hey, if Trump wakes up at 3 a.m. and he's like, you know, Joe and Mika aren't my friends anymore, and it's totally unfair, and, you know, and I feel I'm going to just nuke Guam, actually, because I don't like them, because they embarrass me with North Korea. And Mattis is like, hey, that's not a great idea. You want to play with my gun, Mr. President. I understand, like, I get how that's, when you're dealing with somebody who is just objectively, like, you know, has deeper issues than the issues that most people have, I guess is the most diplomatic way I could put it. Fair enough. But I think that being said, the amount of ink put on that is so dangerous because, as you said, it's dangerous innately to have even the cultural story, let alone the institutional framing, that military people are somehow custodians, not even of really democracy, but of governance, in fact, which are not exactly the same thing.
No, I couldn't agree more. And I almost look at, I think when some of it is done just with generals too, it plays so into that. It's just,
yes.
It's just the, you know, it's the glorification of military.
It's, and think about what they want, like drop the mother of all bombs on Afghanistan, a nuclear posture review,
right,
which resets a new arms race. What they want is demented and dangerous in and of itself.
It is. I tend to look at the military almost like I look at people who are you know, potentially financial figures who come and, mm-hmm. and serve in the Trump administration, or,
yeah.
you know, other various people from other professions who maybe have served more than one Republican in the past, and maybe in the past have done, you know, which tells me that they won't be, because, I mean, again, we're getting down to sort of setting the standards very low here.
Yeah.
It's the sort of yeah. standards are set at the point where, is there somebody there who will prevent him, to go with what you said, from nuking Guam?
Right.
Or is there somebody there who will prevent him from, you know, tweeting out this thing that will cause world market crashes, or, you know, the kind of thing, because clearly he doesn't have the self-restraint to stop himself from doing anything, no matter the consequences. So that the military guys, I think, but I do think that we play into that there's too much glorification, you know, and that's a cultural thing that we do forever, even when it's well-meaning. You know, when it's things like, right. I very much enjoyed the Band of Brothers series that went into, you know, in the 90s, or the whole Greatest Generation thing with Brokaw and Tom Hanks was in all, you know, I mean, while it was worth looking back at what some of these folks endured, particularly in what I think we could call one of the best, you know, at least most justified wars we ever fought, World War II, at the same time, glorifying military in any particular way is a very, you know, cultural thing in a lot of countries, and something we've always tried to avoid in this one. And I think we've been caught in doing that more. So yes, I worry about it. But I guess that's where I'm grasping for straws. I mean, how Rex Tillerson, who's head of a damn oil company, I'm almost looking at him sometimes as a check on Trump in certain ways, like what he calls him a moron. I'm like, good, maybe that means he won't do everything Trump tells him to do. You know, I mean, it's grasping at straws is what it is.
No, I completely understand that impulse. I just think it's important. So even with Tillerson, like, yes, I think, okay, here's a guy who just via the nature, because of the company that he ran, who he is, he by definition is a more intelligent, calculating person than Trump. That being said, I mean, I think he does completely want to hollow out the State Department and have it be simply a vehicle for, you know, natural gas deals and oil deals and other forms of sort of export of U.S. Yep. corporate influence, and is of course an enemy of the environment, and of course an enemy of, you know, standards of development and counteracting abusive regimes and everything else. And of course, you know, they all sat there and supported this, you know, oligarch tax giveaway. So I just think it's important, you know, to keep that frame.
No, we do. I mean, yeah. I think it has to not be glorifying these guys. Right. Have to be remembering that our only choices are our bad and worse.
Right.
So sometimes you hope bad prevents
yes.
worse. It doesn't mean it's good.
No, absolutely. And I think actually, like, as an example, the Iran deal, I mean, that there's no doubt that, and I think actually this is an area where the military guys are crazy. And have, I mean, and,
yes.
and it might be justified from their sense because they have a grievance because of how things played out in Iraq. But from a natural standpoint of just policy, I mean, you know, Tillerson might be one of the only people there who's saying behind closed doors, like, hey, you know, this deal is working. And I don't think it's worth throwing the globe into turmoil and disrupting oil and commodities markets just because you have a hard on about these guys. That could be the case. And if it is the case, then that's a positive thing.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like you're almost looking for any balances of power.
Right.
Sometimes bad forces balance each other, and it's like you're like one bad force balancing the other. It's almost like even Jeff Sessions, who is one of the more horrible human beings probably to ever serve in government. Well, if he wasn't doing what Trump wanted, you know, in terms of killing investigations and whatever, and when Trump was so angry at him, he wanted to fire him, in a way, it kind of was a good thing. Because it means that they're not, instead of conspiring together, there's a balance of power with them fighting each other, and that, you know, that neither
discord
of them
is good.
Fully gets their way is better for all of us.
Oh, yeah, I completely agree with you, which is another reason why the Michael Wolff book is a good thing.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Why don't we just go into, I mean, I want you to just tee off a little bit, because it should be, I mean, we've talked about it before, but just handle discreetly, you know, kind of bring people up to speed on Rob Porter and Kelly's role, because that should be... It's another one of these things that isn't surprising in any way, shape, or form. In some ways, it isn't even structural, right? I mean, it isn't structural, in fact. But it is another one of the where they lay down these markers sometimes where they remind everybody so unambiguously who they are, so that it needs to be reminded through the chain of everybody from some, you know, idiot pundit to Lindsey Graham, anybody running interference on this administration, from first and foremost the policy, but even down to, like, this is what they do to a guy that punches his wife in the eye on his, you know, honeymoon. Like, this is who they are.
And they knew this
right.
for a long time. I mean, and again, you can't start with any organization without looking at who's at the top, because they often set the culture. Mm-hmm. And we have a guy who, of course, infamously, you know, talked about grabbing women in certain parts of their body and forcing kisses upon them and not even waiting and all the other things he said. And he became president.
And you a very credible rape story about him as well, a credible one that we know from his ex-wife's testimony.
With a young woman, but also a credible one where people forget originally that Ivana, in their divorce proceedings, in a legal proceeding where perjury is an issue, said that he raped her.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
She eventually withdrew that.
Right.
Oh, okay, well, there also, if I'm correct, there was another woman who accused him of rape also.
Okay,
whether that's credible or not credible, right. I don't, but... There's a lot of them.
Right.
We've accused him of various forms of assault. We have him on him speaking in his own idiotic tone on video. So it seems pretty clear that's who he is. You know, Corey Lewandowski grabbed a woman by the arm, a reporter, and so hard it left a bruise in her arm, was charged with assault. Did Trump fire him, speak out against him? I mean, eventually they got rid of him when he was no longer of use to them, but not because he assaulted a woman. Steve Bannon was accused of domestic abuse by his wife in divorce proceedings. Did that stop Donald Trump from bringing him in? So this is who they are. I mean, that is the atmosphere there. There is no respect for women and women.
Well, maybe more of the points in the theme of this conversation. Again, though, this is General Kelly, if we're talking specifically. You're totally right. In the Trump Breitbartosphere, it's not acceptable. It's not it should all be held to account in the severest way possible when we're talking about these people. But this was General Kelly specifically knowing.
It's another reinforcement of what we've been talking about.
It's the same thing.
At least to me, General Kelly is of them.
Exactly.
Right? We've determined that he's no different. He's just them with a military title.
Yes.
So he comes in and he's shown the way he'll talk about women before, like with Frederica. I think I said, just actually, I think it was Frederica Wilson. But in any case, you know, he's shown what a bully he is. He's shown what kind of a person he is. He's shown the kind of respect or lack thereof he has for people like dreamers. So it's not a huge leap to get to oh, well, I like that guy. That guy's cool. Good backslapper, smart guy, helps us out. You know, so who cares? He beat a couple women up. Like, what's the big deal?
Right.
And Kelly knew this. And of course, the two different, you know, McGahn, their lawyer, knew this also. And I love how each of them didn't do anything about it and what their reasons were. McGahn, who's the White House counsel, of course, he basically said he relayed the information, shared it when he got it. And that was it. He didn't think to follow up on it because, gee, why would you follow up on something like that?
Right.
I mean, or anything for that matter in this administration. But then Kelly, more importantly, of course, knew about this when he came out and defended spoke out in favor of him and really has kept doing that. And, you know, Kelly's whole thing was, oh, well, yeah, I knew he was kind of a security risk. And I had that on my list. You know, it's like I was going to get around to it. I hadn't gotten around to it yet. I mean, these are the people that made the handling of emails like a world risk, you know, during a campaign.
Right.
And there's all these people that have national security clearance, and Kelly just, you know, can't get around to removing that from them. So just let's let them have it. And he knew who this guy was. He knew what he did. He was made very aware of that, and he still chose to stick by him and defend him. Hell, just yesterday, Orrin Hatch was defending him. I mean, that's who these people are, you know. It really just seems to be the conservative mind that one can only empathize with themselves or people exactly like them.
Right.
You know, they don't get it. Look, she's some woman that the guy beat. I'm sure she had it coming.
I think that's not an exaggeration at all. Do you think I played earlier at the opening of the show this clip of Pence getting confronted about this from two angles? One being like, hey, you know. The subtext being that you still claim to represent sort of like decency or whatever, which is just utterly ludicrous. But I guess it's okay if a reporter's talking to him and they're trying to ask him a question about this. And so the first, there were kind of two parts. And one was that, you know, how do you feel about General Kelly and this story and so on? And his response was essentially like, hey, you know, I'm in Japan and it's great. And this is where we are.
I couldn't hear you. What'd you say?
He didn't even say I couldn't hear you.
Like us. He pulled a Chevy Chase thing where he's like, the microphone's not working.
That would have been more. It would have been more adroit. He literally just said where they were, and then the second part. I mean, the second part was then just basically like, hey, you know, how do you feel about you not knowing so many major things about what's happening in the administration, even though you're supposed to be number two? And he said, oh, well, you know, I'm in Asia and the president's great. Do you think that Pence is done? Like, the fear of Pence is some type of, because my perception of him is that he, you know, there was a lot of fear when they first got in, and I think it was overblown. It was because he did well in a debate against Tim Kaine, which is no great accomplishment, that he's going to be some type of like alternative vector, or, you know, the kind of non, the non grotesque face of Trumpism and Republicanism.
Seems to me he's not popular.
Yeah, I seems to me his brand is shot. I mean, I don't know. Do you agree with that, or do you think he still has opportunity to maneuver and manipulate?
I think his brand is shot among a lot of Republicans. I mean, you know, we all hated him anyhow.
Right,
know,
of course.
Cast him that much more. I mean, the whole, you know, I mean, what's going on with the this openly gay skater, and, you know, the fact that he wouldn't forgive Mike Pence for, I don't know, advocating gay conversion therapy with money that was supposed to go to AIDS treatment, which amounts to taking money away from helping people to torture them. Yeah, I wonder why I wouldn't forgive him for that.
Right.
I mean, I remember the guy, I remember Pence when he was, you know, running that stupid Republican Study Commission, which, if anybody knows, that was the previous incarnation of insanity to the Republican Freedom Coalition now. And when he was a House member, and, you know, you don't have to look very far. You can go back to that. I talk about watching people say what they mean on video. You don't have to go very far to find him making virulently anti-gay statements, virulently anti-women statements. You know, he is what he is. He was a right-wing talker, talk show guy, radio show guy before. I mean, he's a lunatic. So, but he speaks in a softer voice. And for the media, that's like, okay, well, he doesn't do what Louis Gohmert does or whatever, and insult people all the time. So that must mean he's a smart guy because he speaks in a soft voice. And hey, look, that nice full shock of gray hair. I mean, it's like, you know, it's like puppet theater.
Right.
I mean, sometimes, and I don't want to say all members of the media, but some of them are so effing, you know, gullible on this stuff. So there's no way he doesn't know what's going on, I guess is what I'm getting at. Like, there's no way. And the only thing I could say is, again, bar set low. He's smarter than Trump is. Maybe he's smart enough to have set up some sort of plausible deniability. So when, you know, everything falls on Trump, when Mueller gets further along, and maybe we'll find that Pence somehow made sure he, you know, I think back to George H.W. Bush drinking too much tea. So he had to get up and pee and leave the room when they were discussing Iran-Contra. Yeah, that's right. That was actually what he said.
I want another chamomile, so that when you're when you're actually explaining how we're going to secretly smuggle money from proceeds of illegal arms sales to Iran to these death squads in Nicaragua,
I'm
putting water on my face.
I'm out of the room.
Great.
That's what this feels like to me.
Right.
Which is Penn's trying to pretend he doesn't know stuff, and maybe he'll have tried to find a way to erect barriers. But when it comes to the various aspects of the Russia investigation, when it comes to Trump's history of money laundering, when it comes to the emoluments, when it comes to all these things, he's playing a dumb guy, but he's not quite as dumb as he's playing.
He's like Paulie and Goodfellas. He never wants a one-on-one meeting.
That's right.
Yeah.
Fair enough. So that's what I would say with him. I mean, you know, he gets looked at as the adult in the room because he's standing next to, but I think a lot of Republican funders, a lot of your sort of never-Trumpers, many of whom are in the media, a lot of those folks have now sort of said, well, I mean, you know, Pence has been the chief enabler of this. So I do think he's hurt himself. And I do think with certain elements, let's give him credit, there are certain elements of the Christian community, Christian conservative, whatever you want to call them. I think most of them are frankly, especially the big name preachers, are frauds, and they prove that daily by still supporting a guy that paid off a prostitute when they call for family values. But there are certain elements. His numbers have gone down here and there, and so maybe some of the real, and I've seen a few articles by people that sort of consider themselves more moderate-ish evangelicals, maybe they will look at Pence in a different way for what he's enabled. I certainly hope so. You know, I mean,
yeah. I mean, final couple of minutes here. We've been getting some interesting. There's a case in Wisconsin. There's, of course, the really positive development in Pennsylvania, which those Republicans are actually still attempting to subvert in a sort of unbelievable kind of stretch.
Yes, impeachment or actually of very, Supreme Court justices.
Yeah, very believable, actually. It makes total sense. But now there's actually also some good news from Ohio.
There is. And I mean, because, you know, you may have seen the case with our ridiculous vote purging Secretary of State, John Husted. And this is all important because I think each of these states affects the others overall and what they do. And, he, you know, he did one of these things. If you hadn't voted for like an election or two, he purged your name. And who knows how many, I mean, of course, predominantly African-American, Democratic areas, all the stuff you'd expect. So that when Trump won the you know, Ohio by a larger margin than usual, I mean, there's many things that could have been the Comey letter, could have been whatever. But you had to guess a couple points were because of that. You know, so finally they maybe it's because they're getting worried that Democrats are going to sweep the state this year and will take the Secretary of State's office, which in this state plays a huge role, like in Florida and some of the other ones people know about of setting the rules around voting. You know, and it's also somebody that makes the decisions when it comes to congressional and state House and Senate districts here. They're scared, you know, and we could take the governorship. The point being, the Republicans first would have passed a blatant bill that would have been partisan as hell and would have, you know, allowed them to continue doing what they're doing, and it was blocked, which was a big deal. And so they sat down, and it looks like by bringing a lot of attention to this issue, which a lot of people in the state did, and then people nationally, you know, I'm sure you guys have had Ari Berman on, who's written so brilliantly on this, and others, that they were pushed into a point where they actually sat down, and it looks, at least, you know, I'm hearing from people that are on our side and people that believe in fair representation, it looks like this is a smart bill that you cannot pass a map without, even if you control both houses of the legislature. And here there's something called the apportionment board, which is also the Secretary of State, the state auditor, and the governor. Even if you control all that, there are going to be now minority members, minority as in not minorities, but minority party members added two at least, and they're going to have to agree with this map for it to work. So there's going to have to be buy-in from everybody, and that's not what existed before. And people are sort of hailing it here, really people that care about this kind of thing, as a really big deal. So as hard as it is for me to believe, because again, you brought up Wisconsin, and Scott Walker has been horrendous there. Pennsylvania, what they did in the districts, which courts have ordered them to fix, and now they're trying to impeach those guys. I don't know if they'll get there. There's Florida, which has had court decisions against what they have done. I mean, you know, the Republicans artificially, almost fully artificially, have a majority now based on gerrymandered seats. Like I saw an analysis where they have like 24 seat majority. I think I saw an analysis where 23 of those 24 seats came from purely from gerrymandering,
right,
by some statisticians. So, I mean, you know, and the Democrats to win back the House have to win by 6 or 7 points. Right. They can't win back the House by winning 51% of the vote. They need to win about 56, 57%. So it's a big deal because Ohio is the seventh biggest state. It affects things. And it also, when you see what's going on in Pennsylvania and Florida and those places, it will affect what happens there. So it's always nice to end on a good note. And that's honestly, this is one of the best things that to come out of a really just legislature filled with detritus, to be honest with you,
right?
That in the last couple of years, it makes one hopeful. How about that?
Really quick, really brief. What about John Kasich? What does this say about you? Think he's thinking about something in 2020?
I think he definitely is. I think right now I'm looking at. I mean, John Kasich's been positioning himself for this for a while. But I have a feeling, you know, he's not going to run as an independent. So he's going to play the John Huntsman role or the John McCain role. I'll go all the way back to the guy that pretends. I mean, Kasich is, mind you, is very conservative.
Right.
Signed bills, you know, to cut money for clean energy here, yeah. Guns and bars,
attack,
you know,
Planned Parenthood,
abortion rights.
Yep.
Yes, I mean, massive attacks on abortion rights. They've passed 18 different laws attacking abortion rights in the state. He's not a moderate by any stretch of the imagination. He's just not completely nuts, and that makes you a moderate these days. So he's playing that. He thinks he can run and win enough people over. I think there's a bigger anti-Trump faction than there's been anti-far-right faction in the Republican Party, because Trump offends people in so many other ways. But, you know, do I see John Kasich getting it? I think Jeff Flake is gunning for that too,
huh,
in Arizona. That's why he's not. And I don't think either of them has a real shot at.
I'm going to beat both of you easily. In my opinion.
Yeah, the same conservative vote. At this point, I'm going to estimate for you, Michael. I'm not, you know, I don't want to round up again. I think it's about 1.37%.
Yes,
so they should have a shot at that.
And I think I'm going to go. I'm a little tougher than you. I'm going to say 1.2.
Okay.
But I'm still over. I'm still over a percentage point, which is incredibly generous of me. Cliff Schechter.
It really is.
I appreciate your time as always. Unprecedented. Unprecedented.
Close enough. Unprecedented.
Excuse me. I did a Bush joke instead of a. I did a Bush instead of a Trump. I'm sorry.
That's right. You're like, you're on that show. Cliff is a unificator.
Yeah. No, you're not.
You know,
you're definitely not.
Folks, come by and listen. Everything I learned that goes into that show, I learned from Sam and Michael on this show. So, you know, if you like them, you may just like this.
Check it out. Thanks, Cliffy.
Thanks a lot. Take care.
Bye-bye. All right, everybody. We have about 15 minutes or so before we get to the great Corey Pine. So let's do a bit more sound. Rand Paul, who unfortunately is fully recovered. Excuse me, what did I say? You gave me the list of what everybody said about... we'll get to that in a second. And there's a bunch more, right?
You have them, right?
Well, I had a tweet. I can find it.
Yeah. All right, well, we'll start with the sound. So Rand Paul... There was actually a period of time where this dude was like on the cover of Time magazine. And there was this idea, it was another one of these delusional libertarian fads. I'll say this. His father has all sorts of, to be generous, weird beliefs. And his ideas about how the economy works, society works, black people writ large are terrible. But he's an honorable old crackpot, and he was right about a lot of wars, and he's kind of likable in like a ornery old crazy bastard sense who might have a, potentially, I'm just speculating, like a weird reading of World War II. Rand came along. He's got none of his dad's charm, none of his dad's sort of like crackpot somewhat integrity. He said a few good things about Yemen. And he with Bernie was the only one recently to vote to protect the Iran deal. So I'll give him that. But basically, he's trash, and I'm disappointed to see him back. And last night, he did what he's best at, which is a useless public gesture, of which, of course, he's complicit. Like, he's whining about the deficit. So he's going to do a fake government shutdown about the deficits. He just voted for that mass deficit expanding tax redistribution to the ultra wealthy. So even by his logic, he's being hypocritical. But whatever. Let's take in some Rand Paul on the Senate floor.
So I think this has been a very useful debate. And my hope is that those who mutter and say, gosh, why are we having to do this so late at night, will say, why do we do it at all this way? And why can't next year we do it in a better way? Or why can't we begin to do the process of actually sending bills through committee and debating them in a normal fashion? So I, for one, think that this is an important debate and that the future of our country hinges on how much debt we're accumulating. And I hope those who look at this bill, who actually truly do believe that debt is a problem, will consider saying enough's enough and I'm not voting for more debt.
So basically Rand Paul held up. He caused the temporary government shutdown last night. He didn't even wait a full night of doing it, basically. I think it was only a couple of hours, or did it go through the evening? It was a useless, sanctimonious gesture, which he topped off with that useless, sanctimonious speech. But amazingly, there was actually some good that came out of it, which was the responses from some of his fellow Republicans. And I'll start. They're all pretty good, but we'll work our way to the best. John Thune, Republican, is he North or South Dakota, Matt? Do you know?
No, it must be South.
I think, okay, South Dakota. South Dakota Republican John Thune of the Rand Paul filibuster, government shutdown. A colossal waste of time. Richard Shelby, Republican of Alabama. He's tilting at windmills.
Don Quixote.
Do you think he ever read Don Quixote, or is that just in the parlance?
Maybe.
Shelby? Yeah, I remember I read Don Quixote while I was contemplating a way of keeping
Donahue.
Donahue was a very wise man. Why are you entering around the front door? Senator Tillis, North Carolina, I believe. You can make a point all you want, but points are forgotten. There's not a whole of history books about the points, about the great points of the American Senate. A little more clunky, but fair enough.
I think that must have been a whole lot of history books about the great points.
Right. but it was a little truncated. All right, and now I think we have this quote is awesome because, like, I remember we did the reenactment on the Michael Brooks show of Rand Paul getting his ass beat by his neighbor. And what was great was that the whole premise of the joke was that there wasn't any spin on it. There was no, like, oh, what's the angle here? The angle here was that everybody will enjoy a auditory reenactment of Rand Paul getting his ass beat. And a lot of people came, you know, I definitely had people on Twitter, I would say some well-intentioned but far too soft liberals who are going to end up getting us all into gas chambers because they're not even tough enough to joke about Rand Paul getting beat. We're like, well, that's not right. No one should be hurt. And then, of course, a couple of libertarians being like, oh, so he should be hurt because of his ideas, upon which I promptly responded, yes. No, I'm just kidding. I don't want Rand Paul's ribs to be cracked, but I
can't
will
argue that it wouldn't be helpful.
But I can't argue that it isn't funny. I'll start even more simply.
We would never advocate giving Rand Paul a swirly and shoving him in a locker. That would be terrible.
No, but I would say that maybe if that happened to him a lot more in high school, it would have been good. Or maybe it happened too many times. I don't know. I don't know what the solution is with Rand. I mean, Ben Shapiro's the obvious should just have been left in a locker. I don't know what Rand Paul, the solution to Rand Paul is. But this is Representative Charlie Dent. He's supposedly a moderate Republican from Pennsylvania. I'm assuming that he's a, you know, pretty awful politician. But let me tell you something. Combined with the fact that probably he's called a moderate, I'm assuming because he's probably like technically pro-choice or something. So he must have like a handful of positions that aren't offensive. And this quote has just shot him up to what for me, like he's probably in my top 10th of favorite congresspeople. Charlie Dent. When Rand Paul pulls a stunt like this, it's easy to understand why it's difficult to be Rand Paul's next door neighbor. Bravo. Mwah. Not only is that a great line, that creates so much opening for us to do the next Rand Paul gets beat by his neighbor sketch.
Yeah, it actually felt transgressive a little bit when we did it, and now I feel like it's like
raise the bar.
We did a sketch on a leftist politics comedy show in Brooklyn. This guy's essentially a colleague from the same party. He was like, no, I'm not even seriously.
Easy to see why someone would break his ribs.
Easy to see why someone would tackle him while he's on his ride lawnmower and pummel him to the ground. Like it's actually, when you think about it, it's actually kind of messed up. Like, it's pretty, like, he didn't even get like punched in the face. He could have been
beaten within an inch of his life.
He got beat within an inch of his life.
Could have had a rib puncture along.
Yeah, he's like talked for months. Like in his first public statements from him and his wife were like, it's really mean that people were laughing about me being hurt. And this guy's just like, no, but seriously, I.
Like, it's barely okay for us to say it.
No, now now it's very okay for us to say it. That's the point. That's
you
why
just gave him comedic license to say whatever he wants now.
The erosion of norms has its upsides.
That'd be so awesome if when Charlie Dent passed Ryan, like if he or Paul, if they ever passed, he's just like,
or just make lawnmowers.
Hey, Rand, what's going on with your lawn, buddy? It's not looking very well. Don't you need to take care of it? You know how your neighbor feels about a mess. I still am. I really would like to know. It's been really impressive how well they've kept the origin of that feud under wraps.
Yeah, it'd be nice to do like what's that Netflix documentary, the
Wormwood, like an Errol Morris style
recreation of all these different things.
And
would play Rand Paul though? Think on it.
Maybe like Bradley Cooper with a perm.
Yeah, like that. Bradley Cooper would love to play that role. He would be like, I'm stretching, and then the neighbor would be like Mark Ruffalo. Gellert seriously out of shape. And and you know that Errol Morris would do a lot of work with that lawnmower sound. It'd be like,
slow motion blades.
Slow motion blades.
They do a reenactment every time, every single episode. It's a different part of the beatdown.
This needs to be made.
Yeah, like
And then the final episode would be the one that finally showed the full thing uninterrupted. It would be like a, you get milliseconds of it, and then finally in the last one, when the whole puzzle came together, we could watch
some like animated ribs just like cracking.
Well, it's like in Wormwood, it's like, what does it mean to fall out of a window? What does it mean to fall? It's like, what does it mean to get tackled on a lawnmower? How do you get tackled on a lawnmower?
So you leave Congress, you just voted to strip millions of people of their health care and cause their deaths prematurely, and you're on your lawnmower, and your bitch wife won't leave you alone, so you get some peace and quiet, and then what does it mean? Your neighbor, in a fit of Herculean strength, that's the other thing, too, is you never underestimate the raw physical power and rage of an enraged 50-something, like, wealthy white
suburbanite.
Oh, yeah. Those guys, like, they get, you know what, like, we knock them a lot for being soft, but actually, like, I have never seen anybody in my life, and I've been in a fair amount of environments, but some guy, like, 50-something, like, upset at a barbecue is like, okay,
yeah,
whatever you need.
they've got it all bottled up inside because bourgeois life is so emasculating, you know?
That's right. It's like the last, it's like Mitt Romney should be cast in a movie where in the final scene he just like beats a bunch of people to death with a golf club. Like he's just like, oh, okay. I don't want to take it anymore.
Like puts the bodies on the car elevator and like
honey, I'm working.
The one detail that I feel like it's glossed over is that like, Rand Paul is like 5'8". He's not a big guy. And his neighbor is also 5'8". So it's
that's
like he's
I'm
two
saying.
Little guys like
but that's
duking
what
it
I'm
out.
Saying. It's even more impressive.
Jockey
it's,
fight.
It's but that's even more impressive that the guy like was so strong. Like I still want to have a round table with like who do we have? It was Ronnie Casserolls. From the founder of the intelligent co-founder of the armed wing of the African National Congress.
Maybe that Palestinian activist that's like arrested right now.
Yeah, the young Palestinian activist, the Palestinian activist has been arrested right now, and maybe like somebody from Sinn Féin, and then the guy who cracked Rand Paul's ribs, and we could have like a round table on resistance and liberation.
Tactical violence.
It would be so funny, like Ronnie Casserolls is just like, yes, in South Africa, we smuggled in ANC literature in the 70s, but I'm much more interested in hearing about when you finally decided to tackle Rand Paul.
That morning when you heard the lawnmower blades
when you heard
going.
The... it really should be an Errol Morris film. Adam Curtis would have to be less linear.
And then
Adam,
a funny thing happened.
No, Adam Curtis.
And then
like,
a funny thing happened. And Rand Paul got his ribs cracked, and everyone laughed.
And everything started making sense again.
We start in Damascus.
His first positive film. He's like, there's an experiment going on in Kurdish Syria. They're believing in decentralized power because of the writings of a academic in Vermont. Across the world, Rand Paul, the most annoying United States Senator in history, is tackled. All of a sudden, up was down, but people liked it.
Oh, man. That's one for documentary now. It's two for documentary now, actually. Someone called Fred Armisen.
Who's the... Or we could just go really old school and primitive and just do the Michael Moore version, and it could just literally be us. Be like, don't export jobs overseas. Check Rand Paul getting his ribs cracked, dude.
Actually, Mike Hanna narrating the documentary would be a good fill-in for Adam Curtis.
Mike Hanna. Mike Hanna might actually do that. Like a Mike Hanna CNN report. Like, we're here now in Rand Paul's yard where his ribs have been cracked. And I must confess, Michael, it's hard not to laugh.
And I must say, there's some edges trimmed a bit more cleanly.
Charlie Dent just gave us an excuse to spend 15 minutes of airtime joking about all of the, not only the ways in which it's funny that he got his ribs cracked, but the way, like, the different artistic inspirations.
It's more than most Congress people have done for us.
That's exactly right.
It's what we were saying. He only said this because he's not seeking re-election. Like, more people just get in, do your bit, and get out and talk shit about Rand Paul.
I'm exclusively in Congress, too.
If that's why everyone was actually resigning. Like,
I just wanted to say that Rand Paul is the most annoying person I've ever met in my life.
If you elect me to New Jersey 6th District, I promise to just troll Rand Paul.
I'm glad that he got his ribs cracked. And then you do the Arizona guy style. Mic drop. All right, let's we're still waiting on Corey, so let's do a bit more sound. This is just, all right, let's just do this. Omarosa, who is absolutely awesome, I'm sure I would enjoy hanging out with her, was on Big Brother. And wait, you want to start this with the response? Yeah, I think we should start this. I saw this clip because apparently now she's on Celebrity Big Brother and she's talking with another person in the house. I don't know who this other person is. I guess the person's name is Ross Matthews. This is one of those moments where even for me, for all of my just sort of like endless well of cynicism, I'm like, this really is extraordinary that like a senior White House advisor now to the most powerful position in the world politically. She just got bounced from a job and now she's on Celebrity Big Brother talking about the way this guy tweets and how the fact that like we have a just like deeply mental case clown circus going on. She's talking about it like as if she is talking about a breakup on Celebrity Big Brother.
Well, I mean,
and it probably is.
Ross Matthews has some gravitas to talk to, you know, his background.
I have no idea who Ross Matthews is.
He was Ross the intern on Jay Leno.
Oh. Oh my God, Jesus Christ. All right, this is Omarosa, I refuse to figure out her last name, Magrigalt, and Ross Matthews on Big Brother.
The personal toll that I paid was pretty significant.
I feel like you paid the price a couple times, and I feel like you're paying a price now.
Mm-hmm.
After the White House, I see the toll on you. What's going on?
It's like Frost Nixon.
I am in here doing investigative journalism for you all. I'm making headlines for you all. Can I get a little hat that says press on it?
What is it?
Does it feel similar? Or did you figure out that the White House going to be what you thought?
This is 100% worse.
Why?
Because it wasn't a game show. I don't see pain when people talk to me about it, about how afraid they are. Like even Keisha last night, for her to say that it, she thought I was a part of that.
The Obama shirt.
This is not something that I feel good about.
Yeah, you were a part of it, though.
This is not something I was trying to do. Oh, honey.
Oh, honey.
It's not gonna be tough. That wasn't me.
Yes, it was.
No, but you know what, Ross? I made choices. I just have to live with them.
Oh, that's deep shit.
We've been here a couple days, and Omarosa has been a delight. I'm feeling compassion for someone who seems to be in a pivotal moment of their life. But I don't know if it's real. Would you trust her?
And
no, pause it. No, but I would get her number. Omarosa's not looking bad upset.
Yeah. Can I tell you, as a voter, a citizen, I never got it. Why you went to the White House with him.
That's what I was thinking.
It was like a call to duty. I felt like I was serving my country, not serving him. Whenever was it accepting a political appointment, it was always about the country.
Oh my God.
Hell yeah.
Like I was haunted by tweets.
Even this frosty.
Like, what is he gonna tweet?
Does anybody say to him, what are you doing?
I mean, I tried to be that person, and then all of the people around him attacked me. He was like, keep her away. Don't give her access. Don't let her talk to him. And it's like, and vodka's there, Jared's there. And it's, who has that power to say what's going on? No, I'm not there. It's not my circus, not my monkeys. You know, I'd like to say not my room, but I can't say that because, like, it's bad. Should we be worried? Don't say that. Because we are worried, but I need you to say no, it's going to be okay. No, it's going to not be okay.
How is that a question?
It's a question, Jamie. Should we be worried?
So bad. Would you vote for him again? God, no.
Ooh,
never.
That's gotta hurt.
In a million years, never.
Yo, if I would like to invite Omarosa on TMBS, I will help her rehabilitation tour.
It sounds like she learned her lesson.
Yeah, it seems like she really learned her lesson. Isn't she the one who in like the before the election was like, we're keeping a list and President Trump, bow down and President Trump will destroy you. But no, look, I got you. I feel you. I'm sorry, Omarosa. I totally have a lot of empathy for you. And if you want to talk about it, available. Now there is a response from, oh my God, this is another, I can't believe like the white, they at least just stick to the disgusting spokespeople that you already have. Now I've got to keep track of a new one. This is Raj Shah responding to Omarosa. And yes, we are all going to die.
Yes. What is the White House's reaction to comments made by former White House aide Omarosa on Celebrity Big Brother, where she said, quote, she is haunted by the president's tweets. She described the situation inside the White House as bad and said it is not going to be okay.
Not very seriously. Omarosa was fired 3 times on The Apprentice, and this was the 4th time we let her go. She had limited contact with the president while here. She has no contact now.
Roast her, boss.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Wow. Apu nailed it. Apu did a great job there.
Drag her.
Chris Ruddy from Newsmax has a report that Trump is unhappy with Shah's response to this.
Too. Well, it was very low energy.
What part of it?
It was low energy. He should have said not just that she was fired, but that she was pathetic. No one takes what she says seriously. He had pity on her. But frankly, she abused that pity. She got fired all the time because that's what she's... In fact, they should say Omarosa professionally fired because that's what she's best at. These people are fucking amateurs. I could be a great Trump spokesperson.
Don't point out that we
keep...
All
I need to do is shave and he would be totally into it. Dude, all right, second call out. Omarosa, got you. Look, White House, if the number's right... Gross. I finally got a Lek Gross. Yes. That's a major accomplishment in life. All right. That is actually so traumatic and disturbing that the only way I know how to process that is by making that joke. Because even for me to literally say like a dialogue on Celebrity Big Brother is not only like connected to like what's messed up is that what she is doing there is like it's true. Like it's this ridiculous reality show segment, and she's also confirming an obvious reality about the most powerful political office.
Well, it's also like the line of attack from Shah is, we've hired her 4 times, and she's very incompetent.
Yeah.
So, like, joke's on her.
Yeah. We just keep giving her chances. What a loser.
And the obvious reason is because she's one of few black people in Trump's orbit. Like, that's why she keeps getting jobs.
One of a few. One of a few.
Not anymore, though.
Not anymore. All right, guys. We are going to take a brief break. We'll be right back with the great Corey Pine.
Rastafora, yeah. If we do wrong, they complain. Even if we call the Father's name, it's the same. What they want us to do. Don't they know this is not. Let me do my thing, you should be thankful.
Welcome back. Michael Brooks on the Majority Report with the full crew. Joining us now is Corey Pine. He's the host of the News From Nowhere podcast. Brilliant show. I am a Patreon of it. Check it out. He's also author of the forthcoming book, which I have pre-ordered, Live, Work, 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 Die, A Journey into the Savage Heart of Silicon Valley. Corey, how you doing?
Good. I just got my Kirkus review, which is exciting.
Sweet. What does it
say? It's not, as far as I can tell, a starred review, which is a little disappointing, I'll admit.
Really? How does their system work? I don't know how it works.
I don't really know either. I just know starred is good. But it's a clear-headed reckoning with consequences of the tech industry's disruptions and the ideology that undergirds it.
That sounds very starry review to me.
Sounds good. It sounds good. I'm gratified.
Kirkus reviews always read to me almost like Amazon product descriptions, except slightly more normative.
Since they called me a clear-eyed reckoner, I'm going to refrain from commenting on what you just said.
I think that was very clear-eyed of you.
To help with connectivity.
Do you feel like, let's talk about this for a minute. Do you feel like in anticipation of your book that, I mean, not this wouldn't be because of your book per se, but your book is definitely, I mean, this book's going to have a real impact. There's no doubt. And your coverage already has. I think that there's been something of a cultural sea change in terms of how, like, Silicon Valley is a lot less valorized in the culture. And I only see that accelerating.
Well, look at what they're doing.
Yeah, exactly. You know? They were doing it. It was a lagging indicator on finally confronting how corrosive they are.
That's true. I don't know why there's this lag in the culture between like the reality and the people's perceptions catching up to the backlash cycle, you know. But so it is. And, you know, I hope my book's coming out at a time when people are ready to hear it. I think if it had come out a couple of years ago, or certainly in, 2014 or 15, when I started reporting it, it would have been an unwelcome view, but I'm hoping that now it'll be more welcome. I don't have a tech movie to recommend. I haven't seen any good ones.
You didn't like? I actually did like. I liked the Facebook. What is it called? Social Network.
Oh, Social Network.
Yeah, I thought that was actually decent.
You know, actually, it was pretty good. I did love the final scene of that. That was one of the more effective endings in one of those whatever biopic drama movies. I liked it because it was so judgmental of its subjects.
Oh, it was very judgy. The worst tech movie was the. The Jobs movie with who was in it? Fassbender? No, not the one with not the goofball one, not the Ashton Kutcher one, the real one. But that was still terrible. Did you see that?
I didn't. Oh, the Steve Jobs movie?
Yeah, the Steve Jobs movie with who was the?
Why would I see that?
Because you're a tech journalist, Corey. Come on.
Oh, don't call me a tech journalist. I had to correct some editor that called me that at a party once. I was horrified. I had an illustrious career before I got on the subject of tech. And now that this book's coming out, I intend never to write about tech again.
Fair enough.
I feel like I've said everything I need to say in this book. I did like the Blade Runner reboot.
I didn't see it quite a bit.
Blade Runner 2049. I know it was controversial for being too long. Some people said it was misogynist. I thought it was, I could see why they said that, but I think it was actually criticism of, exaggerated depiction of the misogyny in our culture. And, it was quite spooky. It was like an art movie disguised as a sci-fi blockbuster. So I really enjoyed that.
I haven't seen it.
I enjoyed that. I saw that in theaters.
You guys both like that, right?
You should see it in theaters.
Yeah.
The cinematography to nerd out is amazing.
Yeah. Is it still doable to see in theaters? I think it's probably already.
I saw it a second run beer theater here in Portland, so I would imagine that you could probably see it at a place like that in New York.
No, that's good. There aren't that many places like that left here, but I it's weird. I'm not usually like this, but I really did like Blade Runner so much that I kind of just had a little allergy to sort of seeing it. But
I felt that way too, because I really liked the first one. You know, so here's my hot take on the new one is it's really good, and then Harrison Ford shows up and it kind of falls apart at that point.
Oh, really?
I think I can say that without giving a lot of spoilers. Yeah, you know, you sort of realize in a lot of Harrison Ford's recent movie appearances how much of his whole thing was just charm.
He's a charming guy.
Not anymore. He's not a grumpy old man now. And he's not much of an actor, and he probably never was, to be brutally frank about it. But I still thought it was good. I actually thought it was in some ways better than the original Blade Runner.
Oh wow, that's a big claim. You know what I love is I love what I've learned from doing this show and doing this work in general is you never know. Like, you can predict certain things, like, okay, libertarians will freak out about this or whatever. But you, like, when we did they had the author on who critiqued how math was taught in schools and how it was used, like, in this sort of, like, anachronistic way to unnecessarily terrorize children. Yeah, I said it. I had no idea that, like, the math backlash in this audience was genuinely shocking. Like, the fact that we did have, like, endless, like, well, I like geometry and how dare you? So I just feel like your Harrison Ford comment might just set off like a whole tsunami of response that we could never have anticipated.
Well, you know, I loved Indiana Jones when I was a kid. I wanted to be Indiana Jones. Like, that was very common of young boys of my age.
I wanted to be Han Solo. I thought he was cool. I liked the way he shot those aliens at the bar with like the laser thing under the bar stool. That was more my style. I liked that. And the vest.
Well,
it's a good vest.
Well, yeah, for sure. I mean, and I got the Shaggy Doo right now, so I'm keeping that alive.
So you're not hating him that much.
Blade Runner. I made a promise to myself that I was going to boycott all the superhero movies. But then around Christmas time, I did go see Thor Ragnarok, only because of who the director was, I forget his name, but it was one of the guys that did Flight of the Conchords.
Oh, really?
I don't actually, and it was supposed to have a more comedic touch. And I actually didn't think that it was that great of a movie, Thor Ragnarok. I kind of wish that I hadn't broken my superhero boycott to go see it. But I would recommend that people see the director's previous movie called What We Do in the Shadows, which was a New Zealand vampire roommate comedy that came out in...
I'm listening.
I can't believe you haven't seen that already. So.
I haven't seen a lot of movies I should see.
Wow.
What We Do in the Shadows, it is hilarious. And if, you know, it has that awkward Kiwi humor through just beginning to end. It's much funnier than Thor Ragnarok, where that kind of thing was only allowed to peek through in a couple of moments, you know, before the Hollywood sort of hero's journey script writing imperative took over. Mm. What We Do in the Shadows is a much more laid back, you know, visionary and oddball film. So,
is that your pick?
That's not, or, no,
okay,
my real,
yeah, no,
my,
wait, wait, before, real, let's get to that in a second, but first I want to know I could guess it, but I am curious, what's behind the superhero boycott?
I'm just sick of it. I feel like, you know, it's, where is the space for, you know, real, original, creative filmmaking if everything has to be intellectual property, you know?
Yeah, like Patriot Games.
Realize.
Exactly. It's another great Harrison Ford movie.
I'm not anti. I love blockbusters. You know, I'm not that. I do like. I'm going to recommend an art movie, but I love blockbusters. I love shoot 'em ups. I love action movies. Oh, another. I did see an action movie that if anybody likes samurai movies, Blade of the Immortal. It's about an hour too long, but
I would see that. Don't you think what's Hollywood just tracks, like, we have the top heavy inequality economy across every sector, and then we have in tech, there's a few small new lanes that have been created, which are cool, that are openings for like non-traditional content, which has been facilitated by all of these new technologies. But in general, like, Hollywood tracks with everything else, which is that why put money into like the middle brow content when you're not necessarily going to make a big return on it, but it's still enough money that you have to shell out that it's actual money. So you can basically just, you know, have the repeat formulas, know you're going to make a massive amount of bank. You have like a cookie cutter outline for every type of movie possible. And then, you know, on the other end, you could say like, all right, we'll throw somebody a little change to do something on Netflix.
Yeah, that sounds like, I mean, what you described, the process you described, sounds like how you describe a dead artistic medium, you know? I mean, that's just pure commerce. And not that there wasn't, you know, I'm a big fan of 60s, 70s cinema.
Right,
and,
of course.
You know, there was a lot of money behind those movies too, but for some reason, there was still an expectation, I guess, in the studio system that you would have to come to the table with like an original story.
Well, the story that I've heard, and I think film guy Matthew and other people have told, which is basically that, you know, particularly in the 70s, that was the time when really things got opened up, and there was, you know, plenty of bad movies, but you did have an amazing period of time where like mainstream Hollywood was like, you know, Serpico and Dog Day Afternoon and Apocalypse Now and Godfather and all, you know, like Deer Hunter. I mean, really, really good movies. And part of it was that these companies just sort of opened the door. They were like, hey, they were smart enough to kind of realize we don't know what the hell is going on. So let's give you some discretion and let's get some new directors and actors and, you know, let's open the energy up, because we just kind of, in the same way that like almost like a, you know, a brand would hire like a planner today. Like you would say like, oh, okay, I just don't know these trends and culture or whatever. I don't really understand what's going on. I know I kind of need to in order to profit. So there was like a happy medium in the 70s that was kind of produced by that tension of basically the capitalists recognizing that they needed to get actual artists, because their perception was that in order to succeed, they needed to keep up with the culture, which they perceived as being super innovative and kind of pushing edges and wanting high quality. And then Jaws and Star Wars came along and they were like, oh, a shark and like, you know, a classic myth structure told in space. Done. Awesome. We got it. No thanks. We don't need to do any more like, you know, 3-hour character studies anymore. Then we will get our, and then of course, you know, then you get into the 80s and I think all these things track each other. So
yeah, but it's weird, like some of that stuff is getting recycled. Like I love Stranger Things, you know, which is just pure recycling from Spielberg and those Stephen King movies, but it does add depth in a way, even if the cinematography and stuff is not quite up to the par with the original. So there is some value in remixing and mining those things. But
thank you. By the way, I am so sick of seeing these contrarian takes about how Stranger Things was dumb.
Next up in the fun half, I have an alternative take on Stranger Things. I actually don't think it's good.
We're not even in the fun half yet. Do you want to?
It's always the fun half with you, Corey.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Oh, cool.
Do you want to know my pick?
Yes, let's yes, and as you know from watching, listening to the show, that, you know, obviously give us the story behind your pick.
Well, you know, I was like barely awake when you called and asked for movie recommendation. I thought, well this is a lot of pressure.
That's usually how we do it. I call you at 7 Oregon time and I'm like, Corey, hey man,
something new, something like philosophical, something that captures the moment, something that, you know, people probably haven't seen.
Dude,
or something.
It could be anything. If I ever have to do this, I'll say like Super Troopers, because it'll be like the first thing that'll come to my mind, and I like that movie. It's not that
Yeah,
deep.
Well, I overthink it.
Yeah.
But I did eventually arrive at a movie that I think both has some contemporary relevance, since I'm usually on talking about downer politics stuff, and which is artistically very valid, and perhaps a lot of listeners haven't seen. And it's a 1972 film. It was actually the aesthetic inspiration for Apocalypse Now, and it's by one of my favorite directors, Werner Herzog.
Yep.
It's called Aguirre, The Wrath of God.
It's an amazing movie.
You've seen it. Great.
It's unbelievable. I mean, you'll explain. I'll say it's a serious slog, but that's an incredible movie.
Oh, I don't feel like it's a slog. It is. It's only an hour and 35 minutes, according to IMDb.
Well, you know, no, let me rephrase it. It's not that slog is definitely the wrong word. You're right. But it's visceral as hell. So you feel like it was almost like a kinesthetic experience watching that movie. But for me,
it's a fictional story of a doomed Spanish expedition. It follows some conquistadors into the mountains of South America. And it is from the very first shot, incredibly visceral. I mean, it opens with a long shot of a misty sort of forested mountain with just this caravan of conquistadors and mules and slaves trekking down the side of this mountain, and eventually, you know, slowly come to focus on the characters. And Herzog, you know, he got his reputation from movies like this by being a sort of maniac and forcing people to actually go march through these locations.
Is this the one where he threatened the lead actor to like shoot him? Was that?
It was either this one or a very similar movie called Fitzcarraldo that reprises some of the same themes. I mean, one interesting thing about Herzog is he did make the same movie more than once, because he felt like he didn't quite get it right. And I forget if Aguirre came before or after Fitzcarraldo. It's my preferred movie. Fitzcarraldo is more famous because he had his crew and the actors drag a boat over a mountain with ropes.
Yep.
And, you know, this is like, this is not woke filmmaking. I mean, I think Herzog is just a genius, but, you know, animals died in the production.
Yeah.
And the lead actor in Aguirre, Klaus Kinski, is probably a Nazi sympathizer, definitely raped his daughter, is a screaming maniac. And all of that comes through in his performance as this conquistador.
Well, that's what's kind of weird about it is that you're plunging into the depths of some really, really, really ugly, disturbing things. And there is some potency that it was made by people that sort of were that, not people describing it or responding to it, but it was like, you know, that was, yeah, I think it was that film, because I heard an interview with Herzog many years later, and the interviewer was like, you know, you threatened to shoot your lead actor during some scene, and like, I know that you're pretty extreme, and I know that you were brutal on set or whatever, but like, seriously, you were literally going to kill this guy? And Herzog, and this is like so German, I feel like, even if it wasn't, I'm going to pretend it was with Terry Gross, because that makes it funnier. But he was like, you know, Terry, we were in the middle of the Amazon, and yes. He's just basically like, yep. If he didn't nail that scene with, with everybody on the boat, I was going to shoot him in the face.
Well,
that's exactly what I was going to do.
Kinski was a real maniac, and he was abusing the crew and other actors and, you know, threatening to destroy the whole production. So, I mean, you know, Herzog was arguably justified in pulling the gun in that instance, but he did put everyone in the situation.
Yep.
So it's, you know, it's arguable who's crazier. There's actually a movie about their relationship called My Best Fiend, which, if people like Aguirre, would be a good follow-up. This is just a documentary about that kind of backstory. But the reason I like this movie, apart from the aesthetics, which are impeccable, and, you know, the real sort of visceral sense of dread and fear that you get watching the movie, which has, you know, it's very little dialogue. The pacing would be, when you say a slog, the pacing is slow by contemporary standards. But I think it's very effective pacing for what it is, which is a march through the jungle into, oblivion. Right. And it is very literally the story of America. These colonizers killing their way through a native population, searching for gold and spreading some fanatical idea of God. To what end, you know? And as I said, it's a doomed expedition. Talk about good endings. I mean, I think the ending of Aguirre is classic, and it's probably the most remembered part of the movie, where the leader, we'll just say, winds up alone on a raft, screaming to himself.
Yep.
But I don't think don't talk to me about spoilers. I mean,
this is not
about
that,
pain or something.
Right.
It's not going to detract from the experience, but. I think it's a good movie to watch in light of, where we're at with President Trump.
Yep.
And what it's like to sort of be on a forced march with a madman.
Yep. Yep. No, that's a great recommendation. And I haven't watched that movie in quite some time because it's not like, hey, I've got some downtime. I'm going to, but it's an incredible piece of filmmaking, and I agree with you. I mean, and yeah, I like what you said. Literally, it is. I mean, it is that this is like, conquistadors looking for gold, killing anything in their path, and being the sort of like deranged quest of like golden god. That's America, in a lot of ways.
In every way. I mean, sometimes I think about like, I look at my window. There's a cemetery near me. It's a big, beautiful cemetery, almost like a park, and it's just this huge swath of land. And we went on a tour, and it was like, this family, they had this land. It was a corner of their plot. It went from here down to the river, which is like a mile and a half away. I'm like, but where did they get the land? they took it.
Right.
They took it.
Right.
And it's always good. It's always a good reminder.
Knowing history is a good thing. Well, the reason, though, that you say that is because you're an indoctrinated cultural Marxist.
I just found out who Jordan – you guys have been talking about Jordan Peterson for, like, months, I guess.
I was very quick on that one. I think that I was the first person in this case to say, like, have you seen this like Kermit the Frog dude? And other people are like, what? And now he's having his moment. He's popping.
Well, Michael, you find these guys, and I enjoy hearing you, knock them down a few pegs without fail. But sometimes I'm just like, I lose track. They seem interchangeable to me in some sense.
They all have their own.
Peterson.
That's an insult to Jordan Peterson. He ain't no good, Ruben.
But couldn't any one of them host the Bill Maher show and nobody would notice?
I think there would be a lot more pathos if Jordan Peterson hosted Bill Maher's show. That would be amazing. Like, it would go from like, he actually has kind of a Dennis Miller thing. He would be like, it's like, okay, Israel, okay. It's like dating a girl from the Cheetah Club. It's fun, but sometimes you have to say blah, blah. But Jordan Peterson, his opening monologues would be incredible. It'd be, oh, dang, it's absurd.
Yeah, I can't imagine either of them. And Dave Rubin said he's a comedian, but I can't really imagine either of them delivering jokes.
No, I can't. No, I mean, and Dave Rubin is just like sort of relentlessly and determinedly unfunny.
What would Jordan Peterson?
That whole thing with the lipstick and stuff was not a joke.
No, he was serious.
Serious. Shit.
Why? That's arousal. Why?
We don't know the rules.
That's my new thing now. More people better find out who he is, because I'm going to start saying that to a lot of people. Why? Because that signal is arousal. That's why. I love that shit.
Also, the notion that men and women have only been working alongside each other for 40 years is...
40 years.
little
40 years.
A bit of an underestimation.
Stop it. I can't work with you.
It's logic and reason. Don't let facts get in the way of your logic and reason.
Indeed. I'm a trend watcher of the troglodyte. So I'll find the next one. Corey Pine, News from Nowhere podcast. Everybody check it out. Pre-order Live, Work, 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 Die, Journey into the Savage Heart of Silicon Valley. Also, I'm often on Corey's show, and Corey is crew and a regular on TMBS, Michael Brooks' show.
Solidarity.
Thanks, brother.
Yep.
All right, everybody. We're going to go to the fun half. The IMs are on. I'm going to call into the phone system in a minute. Majority.fm/become a member. JustCoffee.coop. Jamie Peck on Patreon. Michael Brooks Show on Patreon. All the stuff. Come on, we got to keep it moving. All right, we'll see you in the fun half. 646-257-3920.
An apple pie.